Thank you.
We call the House Healthcare Committee to order, and thank you all who showed up almost on time, and that's very good, setting good examples. We have a very large number of people who want to testify on 2057 and a smaller number of people who want to testify on the other two, so I think I'll take the other two first. And then move to 2057, and we'll try and figure out how to facilitate their testimony for coming fairly quickly. We have several new members on the committee. We work these bills very intensively in the interim, but I do just want to take a moment before we start on... Do I have to open up one of these first?
When you're ready.
Okay, Tom and Tom.
Yes, you do have to open up a public hearing.
Open up a public hearing on House Bill 2056. And to begin it, I'll ask Mr. Powers and Mr. Burns just to give us a little background on the work we did during the interim. And I will offer those of you who are who were not here during the interim a briefing. In fact, since we have a 10-member committee, we could actually get... as many as all five of you together without violating the quorum rule, simply to brief you on this. And if any of you would like that to happen, please let Sandy know and we'll move ahead. But the way that we can differentiate the two folks in my staff room is that one wears a long tie and one wears a bow tie. So it's easy to tell them. Who starts first, the long tie or the bow tie?
I'll go first, Mr. Chair. Tom Longtie Powers, for the record. Chair Greenlee, members of the committee. To start the testimony out on House Bill 2056, I'd like to preface the entire suite of bills that we're hearing today, 2056, House Bill 2057, and 2059, in reference to the interim actions of the House Committee on Healthcare. I believe in June of 2007, Chair and members of the committee heard a report from the Oregon State Nursing Board about some actions that had been in the news. And that resulted in the office of the chair taking a closer look at all of the health licensing boards in the state. And that was initiated by his staff, at the time myself, going out and interviewing 14 out of the 17, I think, health licensing boards. I missed three of them. But I did finalize that within the summer and completed a report in the early fall that I have given the executive summary to all of you now on the committee. I think some of you were present during the 2007 interim. Welcome new members who are not here. Representative Harker, I believe that you had some of the interim experience on this. But
excuse me just a moment. Could somebody close that back door, please? We're getting a lot of external feedback from outside. Yeah, I'm sorry, Tom. Go ahead.
And before, also, we have an overflow room and hearing room F, but we do have chairs up here towards the front. So anybody who's standing, please try and find a comfortable chair.
And
thank
it's,
you.
The tickets are half price in the overflow room.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I drafted a 60-page full report about each meeting with each of the 14 health regulatory boards. There are three that are absent from that report. But if you take a look at the executive summary that's just been distributed to you, dated October 9th, 2007, you'll get a pretty good feeling about what our office of the chair concluded at that time. Mr. Burns will go into more detail about the recommendations of the Office of Representative Greenlee and what has resulted in House Bills 2056, 2057, and 2059 before you in committee today. But just to give an overview real quick. In meeting with all these boards, I noticed there seemed to be a diverse constellation of boards rather than a central board. And I think that means that Oregon has gone about creating legislation maybe in a more reactive way than in a proactive way in terms of regulating these professions. And that promotes sort of a piecemeal approach to the protection of the consumer and the general public. Other states have gone about consolidating or consolidating either the boards or the staffing of all of these different professions, and Oregon has maintained its system of small boards ranging from 400 licensees up to huge boards with lots of staff and up to upwards of like 20,000 to 40,000 licensees. All these boards do feature a prominent executive director who guide the operations of each board, and generally they manage all the administrative functions of the regulatory agencies. However, it seems sort of inconsistent in statute how these executive directors report either to the board or to the governor and where exactly the responsibilities lie in terms of accountability. There's also a very diverse way in which the boards are composed, from ranging from a board that may have four, a board of five which may have four professional members and one public member, to other boards that have upwards of 33% public members. That is not consistent from board to board. And finally, I also noted that a lot of the effectiveness of the board seemed to be determined on the resources which may be available to the board. And all of these boards use other fees, other funds budgets through license fees rather than pursuing money through the general fund. And three of them in particular are members of the Semi-Independent Boards Association, which means that they do not have to report directly to the legislature to approve their budget. I guess that I'll leave it at that right now unless there are any questions, and let Mr. Burns take over the rest of the work of the Office of the Chair and the rest of the committee.
Are there any questions? Mr. Burns?
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Tom Burns, working as a health policy consultant for the chair. After Mr. Powers' report was released, the Interim House Health Committee held a number of hearings on this subject in an attempt to try and unify how we treated the boards, how we looked at the boards, how the boards functioned, and their governance. You have before you today three of the bills that we specifically looked at during the interim. There are two that are not before you because, as I understand it, they have not been reported yet to this committee. But I'm going to talk in broad general terms about all five of the bills and then focus a little bit on just the three that are before us. So we took five issues for consideration, and this committee approved them for a pre-session filing. The first one is the appointment process, how each board is appointed, approved, not approved, length of service, the ability to remove the board members for whatever reason. It's all over the map on how these boards were done. So we came up with a bill that is 2056. I'm sorry, it's not before you. It's not before you yet. That standardized the appointment process so that if you are the medical board, your appointment process is exactly the same as the Board of Optometry. The second one we did is we looked at public members. As Mr. Powers said, every board has at least one public member. Some boards have as much as 30% of their members public. It was felt by your committee that it should be a 50% minus one public members. And so 2056 addresses that by not increasing the size of any board, but by removing some members of the profession and replacing them with public members, so as to bring more public input into the board structure. The other thing we talked about was the semi-independent boards. There are three boards that are independent of the normal legislative budgetary process, where a board comes through Ways and Means, from the governor's office, through Ways and Means, and their budget and staffing and fee structure is set by the way, by the legislature, and then ultimately used by the boards. Three boards do not do that. Instead, they have their own hiring practices, their own budgetary process, their own fee setting schedule, and at the end of every biennium, they then report after the fact to the legislature about what they did, what their fee structure was, how many licensees they approved, et cetera. And the question that the committee considered during the interim was, why should these three be different than anything else, and is it appropriate? So you have before you 2057, which would bring the three semi-independent boards under the governance of the normal process by which everything else is. We then talked about the impaired professionals issue and how boards handled their professionals who are impaired for drug or alcohol abuse. That is not in front of you today, but your committee adopted a pre-session filing for that, and I guess we'll talk about that next week. And the final one is 2059, which is before you today, and that is the reporting requirements, a mandatory reporting requirements on people who observe medical professionals doing an illegal activity in their medical practice. Currently, there is no process by which people who observe an illegal practice or an improper practice have to report it. Do they report it to the supervisor, who may be in fact a person who committed the problem? Do they report it to the office manager? Do they report it to the board that licensed the provider that took the improper action? And so 2059 sets in place a process by which people who observe it must report it to their own board, and then that board takes it to the board that actually governs the licensee who is at risk. So that's in broad overview the five bills, three of which you have before you today. If you have any more questions as we go through each bill, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay. Well, if you all will just think about this, and if you'd like some further, we're not going to act on any of these bills today. If you'd like some further briefing before we hear them again, which is probably next Wednesday for action, that'll be fine. Thank you both very much. By way of introduction, the whole purpose of this exercise, which began at the last month of the 2007 legislative session, was the sense that there was not necessarily the proper balance in the very difficult job that health professional licensing boards have in balancing their two main tasks. One is the enhancement of the professional practice, and the other is the protection of the public. And to a certain extent, these are both protection of the public issues, but they're not automatically complementary. Sometimes the extent to which a board works to enhance the professional practice and to a certain extent protect the members of the profession is in conflict with the need to protect the public. And we were intrigued to note in a letter that the governor sent to the nursing board with the results of an audit that dealt with several problems that have been going on, and I'm sure most of you are familiar with the historical issues in the nursing board. But the very first paragraph of the letter the governor sent was an admonition to the nursing board to put into their mission statement that their primary responsibility was to protect the public. And that's something that's very important to all of us and our colleagues in the body. And what we're trying to do in these bills is not to harass the boards or harass the professions or anything else, but to do those things we can within our control to move to maximize the public interest and the public safety. Now, if it will save time in testimony on all of these, I think we're all willing to stipulate that Western civilization, as we know it, will come to an end if we do any of the things in these bills. So we all agree with that, and there isn't any need to, in testimony, to reinforce that. But I'd really like you all to focus on the extent to which any comments on these bills and or any suggestions for changes of them focus on how to enhance the board's ability to protect the public. And we'll start with we've opened the hearing on 2056. Incidentally, we're the bill that's not here is the bill on the impaired profession. We expect to have some amendments in front of us at the same time we hear that bill, so we've held that bill off until we get some amendments.
We have a conference call, gentlemen.
Okay.
Whenever you want me
and
to dial.
Would you review 2056 for us?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2056, as both Toms mentioned, is a pre-session file bill by the House Interim Committee on Health Care. I also gave you a one-pager, which basically also summarizes the three bills that are in front of us today. House Bill 2056 increases the number of the public members on the health regulatory boards, and I believe there's 17 of them outlined in the bill. It requires the boards to have one fewer public member than the professional members. It has an emergency clause, which is effective on passage, and we have not changed any of the total membership of any of the boards that we have outlined in the bill.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's have as the first panel, if we can, Dave McTeague, Patrick Bratz, and Lee Howard. Who is a member of the Board of Pharmacy, and we'll get him. So we'll have the Board of Pharmacy, the Board of Chiropractors, and the Board of Dentistry to kick off discussion. And let's hold on just a minute and see if we can get Mr. Howard to join us. And if we can, we'll let him start.
Lee Howard.
Lee Howard, hi. This is Mitch Greenlich, Chair of the House Committee on Health Care, and we're about to open up. We have opened up a public hearing on 2056, and the first panel includes you and Dave McTeague from the chiropractors and Patrick Bratz from the dentists. And how about if you kick off?
Well, thank you very much, Mitch. This is Lee Howard. I'm public member on the Oregon Board of Pharmacy in my second term. I've been on the board for 6 years, currently serving as vice chair of the board. And I want to thank you and the committee for allowing me a few minutes of your time, as I'd like to express some concerns about your bill to change the mix of public and professional members on the Oregon Board of Pharmacy. To increase the number of lay members and reduce the number of professional members, would, in my opinion, greatly reduce the effectiveness and efficiency of the board. We don't just have pharmacists per se. The profession has areas of practice that include retail, wholesale, compounding, hospital setting, corporate, long-term care, out-of-state, and many others. The professional members drawn from these areas help drive policy development work that helps to ensure the public safety and improve the standard of care for the citizens of Oregon. This is a major focus of the board. Lay members make useful contributions to the functioning of the board, but the technical expertise provided by the professionals would be significantly reduced by the reduction of their number. A pharmacist lost off the board concentrates the power into a smaller group rather than spreading the professional judgment over a broader background. Compliance, rule regulation, enforcement, and discipline are determined by the board. A jury of their peers, if you will, relies heavily on the true professionals who provide their experience, insight, and perspective that is imperative to our decision-making process. The board has continually demonstrated that they can operate and function at a high level of effectiveness with their present membership structure. I encourage you not to try to fix something that isn't broken. And I thank you for listening to my comments.
Are there any questions?
Mr. Chair, I do have a question.
Representative Kenemer.
Thank you. I just wondered, how has it worked in finding public members to serve on your board? Has that been difficult? Several boards have indicated that sometimes recruitment of public members for enlarging the boards has been an issue.
Did you hear the question?
I didn't, Mitch. Could you help me with that,
yeah,
please?
Yeah, the question was, how difficult or easy has it been to find public members to serve on the board?
It's been my experience that there has always been more than the necessary applicants for that. What the driver is for a willingness to serve on the board, I don't necessarily know. Some people may have their own special agendas, but as a volunteer board, I think most people are selected on their willingness to serve.
Okay. Yeah. I have a question. Should we add another six professional members to the board?
I'm sorry, one other professional member?
No, six others.
Six other professional members?
Yeah.
I don't think so. My experience has been the larger the membership, the less effective they become. There becomes a point of no return when you get so large. And I think that the numbers that we are working with, we've demonstrated over the years that it is very effective, and the efficacy of the number of present board members, I think, has been demonstrated by some of the major issues we've dealt with.
Should we take out the public members, eliminate them, and have only professional members?
No, I believe public members have a purpose. We are a sounding board. We are concerned and interested in protecting and providing the safety of the constituents of Oregon.
And the current mix is what?
2 and 5.
So we have it exactly right now, huh?
In my estimation, I would agree with you.
So all boards should be 5 and 2?
Pardon me?
Would you suggest that all professional boards become 5 and 2?
I cannot speak for other professional boards. I can only speak from my experience with the pharmacy board.
Okay, well, we'll ask the others, because I think each of the boards appear to have the feeling that they're set up exactly right now. And then there's obviously something we can learn. One of you must be right, I think. And we'll see if we can figure out which one it is.
Well, I appreciate your effort to do that.
Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for testifying, Mr. Howard. I have a question probably similar along the good chair's questioning. So I'm looking at Section 16, which talks about you have 7 members instead of 5 professional, 2 public. It would take you to 4 professional, 3 public. I guess I'm not seeing – that's not a huge diminishment from my perspective of professional expertise. Can you elaborate a little bit more on your concern there? Because it's not like we're taking you – I mean, you have 2 members now. A third would seem to increase the benefit of having the public members, and 4 members of professionals would still be there. So I guess I'm not totally convinced of your concern. Can you elaborate a little more?
I'm sorry, there's a lot of paper shuffling, and I'm not quite sure I understand what you're asking me. If you're asking me, will the increase membership by a public member?
Yeah, good. It's 5 and 2 now,
right.
And I think Representative Kotek, the sense of her question was 4 and 3 doesn't seem all that different. What is it that's setting your hair on fire about this one?
Well,
that isn't exactly the way she said it easier.
No, yeah. I'll take it.
Okay, whose turn?
It's yours.
Thank you. I think if it came down to having more public members, that would be one issue, but not reducing the number of professional members. We have such a diverse population in the professional membership that gives us a broader base of judgment and evaluation. And it's, as I said, it's not just a pharmacist that you go down to your local drugstore to deal with. We deal with pharmacists in a variety of fields of expertise. And because of the numbers, we can get a pretty good broad base expertise from the professional segments. We've had members on the board who are corporate. We had the little mom-and-pop drugstore. We've had compounding pharmacists. We've had hospital pharmacists. We've had pharmacists who have been in prison settings. These all contribute to making the right decisions at the right time.
Well, thank you very much. You're welcome to listen in.
Well, thank you very much. I'm hoping you can hear me from the deep part of the barrel up here.
Oh, is that? I'm sorry. Another question.
Mr. Howard, one of the roles of the board is to conduct disciplinary hearings when a professional is in trouble or a charge has been made against them. Can you comment on the difference in perspective from a public member of the board versus a professional member that knows the operation of the profession in dealing with disciplinary matters?
Mr. Howard, did you hear that question?
I think I understand it as the difference in interpreting an infraction or a disciplinary action by a public member as opposed to a professional member. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's about it, and it was asked by Representative Thompson.
Okay. As you probably know, we have a compliance staff who does our investigations both on complaints and annual tours of all as many operations as they can get to. Based on that, they then file a comprehensive objective report of the infraction or infractions. And the primary concern, whether it be a professional or a public member, is the safety of the patient. The greater the infraction has to deal with, the greater the risk that may be the result of an infraction by a practicing pharmacist. So consequently, I think we are pretty well attuned to realizing the difference between a script fill that called for 30 instead of and was only filled at 18, as opposed to a complete mix of medicines that could be detrimental to their health. So I think we're on the same page with the professionals as far as evaluating the seriousness of the infractions, if you will.
Page. Again, thank you very much. Will you let us know when you're going to be stepping off so we can hang up?
But I'm going to be stepping off. I have to get back to our board meeting.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for allowing me the time.
Bye.
Bye now.
Who's next?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dave McTeague. I'm the Executive Director of the Chiropractic Board of Examiners, and here we are again, another session, another year. Board of Chiropractic, first of all, I want to say, in light of the Chair's remarks, there's absolutely no confusion among the members of the Board of Chiropractic Examiners that their mission is public protection. And we do what we can to educate the profession, who sometimes want us to advocate for their interests, that it's their professional association's job to advocate for their interests. And so we have to struggle with those issues often, but it's a consistent message, and we're very clear what our mission and what our duties and our role is. And we are concerned about the loss of a professional member of our board for some of the reasons that were stated. Professional members have the expertise, so the standards of care within the profession, the medical records, the nuances of patient care, have the knowledge of the different techniques, and there are many within the chiropractic profession. And losing a professional member of our board would impact the remaining members of the board. We're not opposed to more public members, and 10 years ago we came to this committee and we said we need additional representation, public and professional, and we had our board expanded from 5 to 7. We wouldn't oppose an expansion again to a 9-member board. We would prefer it to be an additional professional member and an additional public member. Our professional members' expertise is a precious resource, and service on the board is a heavy commitment, and it comes at a significant cost to their professional practice, some more than others, but some devote a lot of time and energy to representing the board to the profession and to the public, and Their time is very valuable. It's our most precious commodity. Our public members bring an important perspective, and we've got two really great public members right now. Their perspectives of a lot of these cases usually aren't too different from that of the doctors, but they do bring a different perspective that's very valuable and needs to be represented. And I provided you with statements from four of our seven board members to give you a flavor of how they see this from their own personal point of view.
Thank you very much.
And the sky's not falling.
Some canon.
Quick question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. McTeague. You said that you're very clear about your role protecting the public interest, and I assume by we you mean you and the board is
correct.
Very,
the whole
very clear
the
about
agency
it.
And the board.
How do you? Right. How is that role and that value transmitted from one generation of board members to another? In what ways do board members explicitly embody, learn about, talk about
right.
that.
Well, let's start with the appointment process. You know, the governor's office is very good about talking to us and asking about potential, vetting potential board members. Are they experienced? Almost all of our board members have previous service on a board committee. The most important committee of which is the peer review committee, which does some of our heavy lifting on those kinds of cases and investigations where we need an in-depth personal interview with the doctor over all the details of a difficult case, sometimes a long-term treatment case that they really get into the nitty-gritty. That's heavy lifting, and often sometimes our best board members come from that experience, so they're familiar with the board's complaint process and some of the public protection issues that we face. So that's, and then when they come on the board, we meet with them, we go over it, we show them our strategic plan, and we introduce and show them about how we're set up and how we operate and what our purpose is.
Thank you.
May I, Mr. Chair?
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here. I guess one of the questions I would have is just the difference between the two boards that we just are hearing about. Sounds to me like the Board of Pharmacy has investigators
mm-hmm.
who go develop the case and report back. And
you
then,
do.
Well, and that's not clear to me because when I'm reading the testimony from Dr. Guerrero,
uh-huh.
and it sounds like cases are giving to the professional members of the board to review, and so I'm trying
right.
to get a sense of the workload and how much is done by your professional staff, how much is required of the board members to do the work, and if there's a full-blown report being presented by an investigator to all of your board members, I guess I'm trying to figure out the workload.
I mean, it's a variety. Sometimes we get a complaint, and all we need to do is summarize the complaint, write a letter, get the doctor's response, make sure everything's there, and a complete copy of the patient file, put it all together, and give it to the board. That sometimes it's that simple. Other times it needs an in-depth investigation by our investigator, and he focuses in on those issues where there need to be personal interviews, where we need to find witnesses, where we need to find dig out and drill down and get all kinds of information. And sometimes those are boundary cases, which can be long and hard and difficult to investigate. And it's just a variety of things. When we get the information to the level it needs to be at, whatever the kind of case is involved, then we give that to the board. And sometimes they'll kick a case over to the peer review committee for that in-depth interview. They'll do that, write an in-depth report, and give it back to the board. So it just depends on the type of complaint we get as to how we approach it and how we address it.
Well, follow up, Mr. Chair?
Please.
Well, I guess I'm a little confused, and if we could have some further follow-up from all the boards, because I read Dr. Guerrero's testimony, and what it reads to me is we divvy up some responsibilities to board members based on their professional expertise. But
sure.
If they're getting...
All board members get all the complaints
right.
with our board.
Mm-hmm.
We, for the purposes of the board discussion, we say such and such board member, you get to lead the discussion on this complaint. But every board member looks at all the complaints.
Okay.
So if you were assigned the complaint, you would probably spend a little more time on that than you would otherwise. And that's how we do that.
This building is Okay.
So all board members see all complaints and review all the information.
Okay. Well, and the reason I'm asking that is because if there's some assumption that the public, it seems to imply that the public members, since they don't have the professional expertise, aren't as versed, but if they're all getting the same information, then I would assume your public members have some interest in chiropractic care, maybe have been patients of chiropractors. So it's not like they've, you know, there is some context for them to understand. So
I've worked for this board for 13 years, and, you know, chiropractic patient files are often, if not almost always, Greek to me. And I know how to, I mean, I read these things, and they're difficult to read. They're produced in a variety of different ways. The chiropractors seem to have a way to untangle all the hieroglyphics and to understand what it all means in a way a layperson doesn't. And, you know, so I rely on my chiropractors for chiropractic professional expertise. And so if you were to take away one of my board members, I'm going to have 20% less chiropractic professional expertise on my board that I can rely on.
Follow up, and then I'll stop. But
okay.
But so I'm just trying to understand. So I'm starting to think, if I'm your public member on your board,
mm-hmm.
does the investigator write something to the degree that I can understand it? Or if that's not the case, then what
well,
if you put your public members in?
Well, the investigator's not a chiropractor either.
Okay.
And anything he writes,
they understand
you will be
what's
able
going
to
on.
Understand. But he does in-depth investigative reports on only a portion of our complaint load, and he focuses us in on those issues that need that kind of in-depth investigation. Now, we have a peer review committee to do the in-depth clinical chiropractic investigation on those few cases where that's needed, and their report goes back to the board. And that's information that the board members, the professional members, can understand better than the public members.
But if you can explain it to two, you could explain it to three, right?
I suppose you could.
Thank you for the questioning, Mr. Chair.
Hey, Mr. Chair, thank you. Question is about workload for your meeting. Can you give me a size? How big is a stack for each board member at each meeting?
This board meeting, the one I have in tomorrow, is a light, very light one. I've had meetings where I've given them this much information, patient file information,
is
complaints.
That,
so
Mr.
it varies.
Mr. Chair, follow.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Is that an exaggeration? Because 500 sheets is about an inch and a half thick,
mm-hmm.
2 inches.
Oh, yeah.
So we're talking thousands of pages per meeting.
There have been board packets that big, yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Not every meeting, fortunately, but there have been some.
Representative Bruin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. McTeague. At the board meetings, okay, so a stack of complaints, whether it's that big or that big, mm-hmm. is there a board vote on every single complaint? Help me understand.
Ultimately, yes.
Okay. So, I mean, any given meeting, there's 10 or 12 votes generally? Is that... I mean, there's a lot of votes.
There could be 15
okay.
to 30 votes.
My question mm-hmm. is, how often, with your seven-member committee, five are professionals, two are public, how often is there a split vote? Is it a common occurrence? Is it an uncommon occurrence? And what drives, if it's, I mean, my impression, not necessarily a legislative committee, but boards usually find a way to find common agreement.
Usually.
And it's not usually about a majority. It's about, usually. Where is
more often than
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Committee.
Yeah.
Your mouth to God's ear.
Right. Is that happening? Are there many instances where the public at the public members are voting differently than the professionals, or is there usually some sort of mostly an agreement?
They mostly come to an agreement and a consensus through discussion. There are instances where they have a difference in, say, the level of sanction. Some board member says this should be a $5,000 fine instead of a $500 fine, and they'll split on issues like that. They have differences of opinion occasionally, and they'll express that in a vote, but it's mostly not very often, but it does happen.
Okay, one more follow-up. How often do the two public members vote differently? Once again, I realize you're talking hundreds of votes over what a period of time, but
I think
are the public members usually on the same page with a vote?
Usually, right.
Okay. Even if some of the rest of the professional boards go in the other direction?
Yeah, it doesn't seem to divide out in terms of public versus professional. people will have different points of view, and some the professionals will often disagree on the extent.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Chair Greenlick, my name is Patrick Bratz.
I do want to comment on how much both of you and other execs around here have been extraordinarily supportive of this work. We've been bothering you a lot over the last 2 years now, and you all, I see other members out in the audience, you've been extraordinarily cooperative with us.
And Mr. Chair, I'd like to also say, I do read you, I get your newsletter, and I see the number of, you actually are very explanatory on what's going on in your professional community, and I appreciate that. And I know, and you have a lot of things you have to go through. So if people haven't read your newsletter, it's pretty enlightening.
You all get it. So
it's all pretty enlightening stuff. So thank you.
Thank you for your comments, Chair Greenlick. And from my personally, it's not a bother. We like being here.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
is that a model of how truthful the rest of your testimony is going to be?
I thought I'd start on a light note. As you said earlier, that the whole world's going to end if these various bills pass, and that's not the truth. And I'm not going to read my testimony, and I'm actually going to try to answer a couple of the questions that came in. But basically, the issue that we're looking at for the Board of Dentistry is this bill would take three professional members off the board and replace it with three public members. That is a lot of dental expertise to lose on the Board of Dentistry. The way we do our cases at the Board of Dentistry is a complaint comes in. We have a professional investigative staff. I have a dental director on staff. I also have a consultant dental director. And then I have two professional investigators. They're individuals who are from the law enforcement field, the customs field. They prepare a case report for the board, for all members of the board. And they prepare it at a level that has both the technical and the dental in it, as well as Representative Kotek said, to be able to be read by myself because I'm not a dentist. We try to point out for the public members and for the Assistant Attorney General who sits at our meeting the issues that are before the board so they can make some decisions. Dentistry, like pharmacy, has a very large field of specialties. We do not have all those specialties represented on the board, not even within the specialty of general dentistry. There are some people that do an extensive amount of restorative work, and some people do it sending information out or sending things out to labs. Some do it in their office. So there's different levels that they do that. In losing three members of the board, professional members, it will seriously jeopardize how we facilitate the cases. As Dave said, our board books used to be about this big. Now, we actually do everything on a thumb drive now because we're trying to save paper and save a few trees. On average, we do about 50 cases at a board meeting. So there are some 50-plus votes that take place at a board meeting. How often do those board members split? Not very often, but when the split usually happens, it's not the public member, it's the professional members. What I've witnessed in my 6 years here in Oregon and 11 years back in Wisconsin doing regulatory is it is the professional members that want to be tougher on the profession than the public members. I mean, we sometimes have to, as I say to my colleague, Dr. Kleinstub, who's our dental director, we have to sometimes pull them back a little bit because they'd like to take the dentist down to Pioneer Square and flog them. And we say, no, you can't do that. We got to have enough evidence. We've got to lead this way. Maybe there's another solution. Very seldom, unless it would be in probably the areas of sexual misconduct, have I ever heard public members really be more heavy-handed toward professional members. It's usually the professional members that want to really do more discipline than the public members. And this board, I agree with you, from the day I came here 6 years ago, I thought only one public board member was not enough on the board. I came from regulating 13 different boards in Wisconsin where at least two or three public board members were on the board. So I agree that we need some additional public members, but I, like the other ones that have testified, I really do not want to lose the dental expertise I have because I believe it will jeopardize how efficient and effective we are in processing the cases that we have. And so that's the testimony, and I know you've heard that testimony before. We really think that's important. And public members play a very important role. They are there watching the process. They are there participating in the process. And as I always like to say it, it's so the fox isn't guarding the hen house. I mean, if our public member, David Smith, thought that the board...
guardian.
Well, if he thought that the board was not taking appropriate action, he would stand up and say so. And I have to tell you that when he speaks in the board meeting, all the board members listen, and they would not close a case if they were not able to convince him that the case should be closed. They would continue investigation, they would continue discussion, because they value his opinion that much. And if there were two David Smiths, they'd value those two opinions. But to remove three professional members from this board is really going to be a detriment to the board and how it does its mission, protecting the public.
Can we set the record straight on that? Right now you have four dentists, two hygienists, and one public member.
No, I have six dentists, two hygienists,
and
one.
Six dentists.
Yes.
So two hygienists and one. So you
have
go
nine
from,
members.
From six to four dentists.
Four dentists, one hygienist.
And from two to one hygienist, and from one to four public members.
That's correct. But losing two dentists as well as the hygienist is a very big loss of expertise.
How many chiropractors do you have?
Five chiropractors and two public members.
Any questions?
Thank you, Mr.
Okay.
Chair. Thank you for being here, Patrick.
A question
about you regulate dentists and dental hygienists, just those two.
Correct.
Does this proportion adequately address, if you have X number of dentists and X number of dental hygienists, some proportionality on your board? I don't know the numbers of dentists versus dental hygienists, because going down to one dental hygienist, I don't know how many you represent. That seems small.
Right.
But I don't have a good sense.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kotek, we represent the dentistry and dental hygiene profession are almost evenly split, about 3,800 to 3,700 licensees. That's in-state and out-state individuals. When you're just looking at in-state, it's maybe a few more dentists than hygienists. But the majority of our cases, at least 98% of them, are in the field of dentistry. It is very seldom that we will have a dental hygiene case. So you could say, well, why do you need dental hygienists? Well, they play a very integral role in the practice of dentistry. I mean, they're doing a lot of things, and they're seeing a lot of things. And when it comes to periodontal issues, they are definitely very voiceful or strong voices on the board. So going down to one, yeah, you would really be losing quite a bit to the profession if there was only one hygienist. But to say, well, why don't you have even hygienists and dentists, you could say that from a public policy standpoint, but from pure investigative and enforcement, then we would again be losing the dental expertise that we need.
Hello?
Okay, yeah, I think we need to move on.
Okay, well, and this is an issue on some of the other boards of, I think, inequity on who's on their board, because this goes beyond disciplinary issues. You're making policy choices for the entire profession, and when half of your profession that you represent is dental hygienists, and you have less than that percentage, I just think it's something we have to keep in mind for all of the boards, in addition to the public member issue. So, but thank you for answering the question.
Thank you.
Very quickly, thank you, Mr. Chair. What's attendance like at board meetings? How often are board members, do they have to be absent from board meetings?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Cannon, very seldom are our board members absent from a meeting. We plan our meetings a year in advance, so they're able to do their schedules, especially the professional members. On occasion, something will come up. You know, they'll have a procedure or something will have happened in their office that they can't make, but it's very seldom that I have a board member absent.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. So since you had the experience of serving in a system where there were two or three public members on the board, you're in a good position to tell us how that was an advantage over just having one. You know, you're suggesting we increase by one. So what is added by having more than one board member?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Burrow. I think what happens is just like anything, if this committee had 10 people and had 9 Democrats and 1 Republican, well, the Republican doesn't have anybody else to side with them or whatever, if that happens to be the issue. I think it's the commonality. I think there are the issues that they can discuss things together. They have a colleague and things of that nature. That's what I saw from Wisconsin, where we had 2 or 3 public board members. Again, it wasn't usually that the public board members disagreed with each other, or again that they disagreed with the professional members. It just gave them another colleague on the board, which helped enhance some of the things, maybe thought of questions that they wouldn't have thought of. So, you know, I thought from day one when I came here it was strange to only have one public board member, but that was the setup there was.
Thank you. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
We have 3 more for our panel on this. Yi Kong Ho, Glenn Taylor, and Wesley Vorpal. We're going to try and finish this just after 4. We've got a bunch of stuff to do. Long way to go today. Any order.
Okay, I go first. Thank you for having me, dear committee members. My name is Ekan Hu. I'm a lawyer, and I have served on the board of Naturopathic Examiner as a public member for over 2 years. I'm here to share with you my personal experience serving as a public member on a health regulatory board, and to let you know that while I do not oppose House Bill 2056 goal of increasing number of public member on health regulatory boards, I also, frankly, do not see a need for it right now. It's not difficult to see that public safety must have been a large driving force behind this bill. However, if you have any concern or reservation that a healthcare professional could not or will not police one of their own when they serve on the board, I can assure you that I have not seen anything like that that would justify such concern or reservations. During the past 2 years, I've worked with my fellow board members, which include 5 naturopathic physicians and 1 additional public member, on a variety of public safety issues. This included creating and implementing a background check system for new licensees, denying licensure of a new applicant, suspending a physician's prescribing privilege, and revoking another physician's license. When we were working on these difficult cases, each of the board members, naturopathic doctors, and public members alike took his or her job seriously, and we carefully considered all the facts and legal options before us before taking any action. At no time did I feel any pressure from any board member to change my vote, and the naturopathic physician on board never hesitated to impose severe penalties or implement any corrective action necessary to ensure public safety. In summary, as a public member on a health regulatory board, I do not see a need for HB 2056 and will encourage the committee and the legislature to invest its limited resources on more pressing issues facing our state at this time. Thank you for the opportunity to present my testimony before you. Thank you.
Thank you. Is this the first time you've testified in the legislature?
Is that obvious?
No, it isn't. It's just, I know it's always an interesting experience.
Yeah. So
thank you very much for coming. Yes.
Chair Greenlich, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Wesley Vorpal, and I am a practicing optometric physician here in Salem, and I currently serve as vice president for the Oregon Board of Optometry. The Oregon Board of Optometry does not disagree with the concept of increasing public representation on our board. We do, however, as others have, object to decreasing the number or the representation of professionals on the board. Much of the work that we do involves significant knowledge in various areas of optometry, and we believe that the number that we have now, 4 members, is necessary. We do not object to increasing the number of public members to 2 from 1. And we really have found that the current professional representation does allow us to function well along with the public member that we have. And with regards to that public member and how she functions, at least at this time alone, she is an attorney, and she does an excellent job. I don't think that she feels lonely, and she's more than happy to express her opinions, and she is an excellent member of the committee. We are blessed. We would suggest a board consisting of 2 public members and continuing with 4 public members would function well and address the concerns that this bill is trying to address. If this bill were amended in that manner, we would support it. As it currently stands, we would ask that you do not vote for it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chairman Greenlich, members of the committee, my name is Glenn Taylor, a public member of the Oregon Board of Naturopathic Examiners, and I'm primarily speaking to Section 11, which amends the seven-member board to consist of four naturopathic physicians and three public members rather than the current five naturopathic physicians and two public members. As a public member, I know that my input and comments are welcomed and considered by my fellow members who are physicians, and that they value the public perspective as we conduct our business. Our two-sevenths representation is more than adequate, and we're fully included and active in all board meetings. I rely on those members who are naturopathic physicians to provide the technical, medical, and treatment expertise required to evaluate licensee misconduct or consider rulemaking issues. And I value having a variety of experts to help educate me on those areas beyond my training and knowledge, and appreciate having as many of them available to me as possible. Reducing the number of any physician members would not benefit me in my public role. One of the areas we review as a board is continuing medical education, which by its nature requires naturopathic physician review. The public members are unable to help with this task, and further reducing their numbers would place a larger load on the remaining naturopathic physician members. Finding public members with the time, inclination, and interest in serving appears at times to be difficult, as vacancies on the board for public positions have sat unfilled for extended periods of time before members were identified and appointed. Increasing the public positions to three could increase the chances of having vacant positions, which can affect negatively the work of the board. As a general note, in my reading of the bill, I understand that all boards would have more public members and less members from the profession. I believe that that from all of my previously mentioned concerns as they relate to the Oregon Board of Naturopathic Examiners, that they would apply equally to those other boards, and that responsible oversight of licensees is not increased but diluted through the addition of more board members without specific training, knowledge, and expertise in their particular area. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions of this panel? Thank you all.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For either of the public members of these committees, it seems that there is at times difficulty in finding public members. I'm curious as to what your motivation is in serving there.
My motivation probably came from having worked at the Naturopathic College for many years, and so having an awareness of what the profession was all about and an interest in the medicine, and also an interest in that becoming better understood from the public. So I was intrigued by the aspect of being able to do those, having some knowledge, but also being able to help protect the public from what I thought was a great opportunity for them to have.
And my desire is also to serve the public. My background is science and law. I have a PhD in biochemistry, and I'm a regulatory attorney specializing in FDA law. So I thought it was a good way to serve the public by both my scientific and legal background to serve the public.
Thank you for your answers and for your service.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to acknowledge for the record that we have some written testimony on House Bill 2056 from Charles Murphy that will be submitted into the record, and I believe that you all have copies of it for your bill file also. Thank you.
We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2056 and see if we can move expeditiously through a public hearing on 2059. I do want to tell you that I do not think 2059 is quite ready in its current form for prime time. And I intend to ask Representative Garrett to lead a work group we'll talk about on making sure the language of this bill does precisely what we intended to do. The bill was triggered by a case where nurses working for an oral surgeon observed improper conduct on the part of an anesthesiologist who was working on a case and reported the misconduct to the oral surgeon. And the
things that resulted from that was not a very clear pathway to getting this case settled. It ended up in a very complicated, litigious process, but it was very clear that the nurses did not have a clear path in this case to reporting the conduct, and it wasn't quite clear who the oral surgeon reported to what extent the oral surgeon reported to dentistry or to medicine, and it was a very complicated case. What we intend in this bill is to make it very clear, particularly around issues of observing sexual misconduct and other serious kinds of misconduct, that there's a clear path for health professionals to report that in a way that it can be adjudicated and some folks can take responsibility for dealing with it. I think we may not have that language quite right, but let's call... Open a public hearing on 2059. I'll call Rose Jade, Heather Benin, is it? Benoit, and let's have those two first, and then we'll have Kathleen Haley and Bruce Bishop next. And if particularly for Kathleen and Bruce, if you have some clear suggestions on how to make sure we're saying what we think we're saying, that would be better. Please, whichever one.
Okay, we know each other. Committee Chair Greenlake and the rest of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I've submitted a letter in opposition to this bill, and I wanted to submit a second letter that I include some proposed amendments. I would like to see massage therapists completely exempted from this bill. I understand your goal, and I just feel that licensed massage therapists are in a different position than many of the other healthcare licensees involved here. And especially with the fact that the prohibited conduct phrase includes every possible rule violation.
Yeah, it needs not to include that. We're very clear about
and,
that.
And well, I guess my basic question is there something currently wrong with our statutory board or tort system such that this type of mandatory reporting is necessary? And given the problems that mandatory reporting cause, especially in an office situation where, if a massage therapist was working with a chiropractor or in another office, she's going to fear losing her job if she reports this, first of all. And because she's going to fear reprisal from other coworkers and from her boss, probably. She's probably going to be reporting another massage therapist or her boss. And the reality of this being workable in our communities, I just don't think it is. But I've already given you my written testimony, so I'll end there. And I would like to, if you are going to have a committee work on this, I would love to have a word with
it. I just want to make sure I understand your position. If you as a massage therapist see, say, a chiropractor sexually abusing a patient, you, because of fear of reprisal, you wouldn't see any need to report it?
No, that's not my position. I would report it to the district attorney immediately. That's just me. I feel completely free and able to report something like that to a number of boards without a mandatory reporting bill. I feel like I could report that to a police officer or a DA or the chiropractic board. I'm just saying that making it mandatory isn't going to do much more, I don't think, except change the focus from the bad actor, the chiropractor, to me for not mandatorily reporting it.
Okay.
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, thank you. My concern with this is the method
Would you introduce yourself,
I'm
please?
Sorry. My name is Serena Benori. I go by Heather. And I am on the Oregon Massage Therapists Association Executive Committee and serve on the Rules Committee for the Oregon Board of Massage Therapists. Massage therapy already has mandatory reporting of fellow licensed massage therapists for violating any of our practices in place, and that at the current time seems to be working quite well. My concerns are more related to the fact of how this is set up. So I was quite relieved, Chair Greenlick, to hear you say that there will be some revisions ahead, and I look forward to seeing those. One of the things I would like you to consider in terms of setting up a channel, I'm a little reluctant on the mandatory phrase, but is not having us go through our personal board as a health professional, but have that avenue set up where we go to the board of the offending health professional. Setting it up to go through our board actually takes away some of our rights as an individual when it is mandatory that it goes to our board first, that a member of the general public could go directly to the offending practitioner's board, and we would no longer have that avenue.
Perhaps I can clarify. I think what you're saying is that you believe that this bill, if it became law, would prohibit a massage therapist, for instance, for reporting a misconduct on the part of a doctor, makeup, whatever other profession, to their board, mm-hmm. because it mandates reporting it to your own board. I'm not sure that's in fact the case, that it would prohibit reporting to a separate board. It would, I believe, mandate reporting it to your own board. I'm not that part of it is what raised my eyebrows as perhaps not.
I don't see why it would be necessary to report another health professional, and I don't want to pick on another specific profession, but since many massage therapists work for another health professional, I don't see where getting our board involved is necessary in the process of a different health profession's issues. I think it adds an unnecessary step both to our board and in the administrative process of handling something that comes up.
Just to follow up, you would prefer to report directly to the board of the offending professional.
And I think having an appropriate channel, which sounds like was one of the issues that brought this bill about, having an appropriate channel so in the case presented the nurse knew who to report to and it was handled in a more efficient manner, I think setting up an appropriate channel is good, but that channel needs to be more efficient instead of hopping through several boards to get to the right person. Setting up in a channel, I am not opposed to making it completely mandatory. I'm reluctant on. We already have mandatory reporting for licensed massage therapists, so that's in place for us.
You wouldn't
personally
have any problem with it if it was mandatory, that if you're working in a orthopedist office, say, and you see the boss sexually abusing a patient, you wouldn't have any problem being a mandatory reporter to the medical board?
I would have far less problem with that. I have some small issues with the mandatory reporting, but I don't like the fact that we would have to go to our own board first.
Interesting. Okay. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to clarify, to both of you, and thank you for being here, what is the level of, what are you required now as licensees for reporting? There's the child abuse reporting, but there's nothing on top of that, is there?
Yes, there is.
I disagree. I disagree. I'm an attorney. I'm a licensed massage therapist. I've read the rules. I've read the statutes. I don't believe as a massage therapist I'm a mandatory reporter for anything. I think I'm a mandatory cooperator with the board, but I do not believe, and I've shown the board my letter to you, I do not believe I'm a mandatory reporter. There's nothing in the statute or rule that specifically states you shall mandatory report XYZ.
Ms. Bernard?
I respectfully disagree. It is one of the fundamental canons for the board in the massage law, the statutes. Set out for massage therapists.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now that we've settled that question. Ms. Haley and Mr. Bishop.
Are you asking me to answer? I asked Pierre. Are you asking me?
Good afternoon.
We have the Gnome of Beaverton with us today. It's a great honor. You're not here lobbying, right?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kathleen Haley, and I'm the executive director of the Oregon Medical Board. The Oregon Medical Board is responsible for the general supervision over the practice of medicine in Oregon. We have approximately 17,000 licensees. And the statute and the mission are very clear that the board's charge is to protect the public. We currently have 12 members, 2 public members, 7 MDs, 2 DOs, and 1 doctor of podiatric medicine. The board supports House Bill 2059, which requires, as I understand it, licensees of health professional regulatory boards to report prohibited conduct to the health professional regulatory board for the appropriate licensing. While it is current practice for one profession to report another, the board believes that to have it in statute will further the board's mission of public safety and ensure that a report is forthcoming. Also, the immunity provision provided in ORS 676.170 will allow more individuals to report prohibited conduct without any fear of litigation. The board looks forward to further collaboration with other health regulatory boards and protection of the public through this implementation of this statute. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions? I can predict that you, for the newer members of the committee, you'll get to know Ms. Haley very well before we're done. Bruce.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the record. I'm Bruce Bishop. I'm appearing on behalf of Northwest Permanente, which is the medical group associated with Kaiser Permanente. We have concerns about House Bill 2059. I was pleased to learn from the chair in his opening comments that the language isn't quite right yet. We would agree with that analysis of the bill. I've given you written testimony to express sort of the complications that we see with the approach the bill has taken. And I included a chart as an attachment to the testimony that identifies the 27 statutory grounds that are listed in the statute for the Oregon Medical Board that, as Ms. Haley explained, regulates the conduct of physicians and other health practitioners. Based on my interpretation of those statutory requirements, it looks like there are maybe 3 types of misconduct that could be the cause of disciplinary action by the board that necessarily involve a patient. There are about 24 that don't necessarily involve a patient. And the way the bill is drafted, it is only conduct involving a patient that is required to be reported. It may be that that's because of the chair's explanation that there's certain kinds of specific conduct that the bill is targeted at. But as it's drafted now, the bill requires the reporting of all misconduct involving a patient, and all of the grounds of disciplinary action may not rise to that level. What that presents, I think, for licensees is a very complicated matrix of trying to understand not only their own professional standards, but the standards of every other health professional, and then knowing whether or not they are obligated to report misconduct of another type of practitioner. I don't think that's a bad idea. I think it's just very complicated to put into law and to achieve the reporting results that you're trying to get at. There will be substantial additional time required for training for health practitioners to understand what their reporting requirements are. These are mandatory reporting requirements, so the failure to report misconduct will subject a licensee to disciplinary action from his or her own licensing board. So that would be one of the consequences if somebody failed to satisfy the reporting requirements that we think may be a concern. There's also a requirement that the reports be made immediately. So not making the report immediately could also trigger a disciplinary action. It's those specific provisions in the bill that we think are troublesome and need to be ironed out before the bill proceeds. We would be happy to, I would be happy to answer any questions or to work with the committee further on the legislation.
I think we'll hold questions right now.
Thank you.
We'll feel free to call on both of you for help in this area. Is there someone coming?
No. I guess I will. Thank you. It just seems to me that as a legislator, I'm a mandatory reporter. Not in the same sense that this bill addresses, but if I see child abuse, I'm obligated by law to report it to law enforcement.
If you have reasonable...
If I have reasonable... Okay.
Yeah, it's even broader than seeing it.
And if I don't report it, I'm subject to legal consequences for failure to report. So I think that if you see misconduct, then you need to report that. Now, what is misconduct? And I think that is being addressed by what you bring out. But clearly, and to suggest that you're worried about being litigated or you're worried about your board because you see a child being abused or some other major criminal offense, I think is kind of not where we need to be. We need to focus on what this bill is, and I hope we can salvage it.
I think we can. But I think if we're creating a new class of mandatory reporters or something, we better make damn sure that we're making clear what it is
that
people are being required to report about. I think that's the obligation that I see. And when I saw the language of this, it's, for example, I would have to report a physician who violated the rules of the medical board without having any clue what the rules of the medical board were, like hiring somebody to solicit patients. I mean, it's complicated, but yeah, we have an attorney and we have some other health professionals around here, and I think we can get some help getting this in the way we need to get
just
it.
Just what we need is an attorney.
we had a wonderful attorney last session, and I think our representations from the legal profession on the committee is very good shape. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
I'll close the public hearing on. Which bill? 205, 205-9. Open a public hearing on 2057.
Well, we wanted Dawn Farr here from LFO, but she's not here right now.
Will you see if we can get her here?
We already called. She should be on her way. But if you want to
I think we want to have a brief explanation of what we're trying to do here.
Okay.
And
so she...
Yeah. She's on her way. It might be worth it. What I'm trying to do, we have three boards primarily involved in this discussion because there are three boards that hold semi-autonomous state status, and I suspect most of the testimony will be from one of the three boards. So we're trying to create some panels here that can make some sense. And can we start with you answering the question, what difference does it make whether...
No.
Whether a board is semi-independent or has semi-independent status or not in terms of the legislative process.
Well, she can only give it to you from the fiscal perspective.
Well, that's the most important issue, I think.
Okay.
So give it to us LFO prospect.
Exactly.
So my name's Dawn Farr with the Legislative Fiscal Office. I'm a little out of breath.
Hi, Dawn.
So I understand the question, What I'm able to offer, and I think, did you all get a copy of the report?
We have it in front of us.
Okay. The Legislative Fiscal Office, what's the difference between, first of all, we're the budget shop of the legislature, so we attend to getting to a balanced state budget. And what's the difference between someone like the nursing board and the board of massage therapists, who's a semi-independent agency? From a budgetary perspective, someone like the nursing board would come through the full state budgeting process. So they'd go through the governor's recommended budget, they'd come over here, and we would do a budget development process through the Ways and Means and get to a legislatively approved budget. So there would be a legislative oversight in terms of the development of the budget for someone like the nursing board. When you look at the massage therapist as a semi-independent...
Included in that is also some performance measures, would you comment?
Correct. Thank you. Part of the budget process includes a series of key performance measures. So as the subcommittees look at the budget components, they also look at and approve a set of key performance measures for each agency. So the semi-independent, someone such as the massage board, is outside that umbrella. So they don't go through the normal budget process. I understand that the boards are their oversight mechanism in terms of approving their budget. But there are several semi-independent agencies that are subject to legislative fiscal office review. So what you have before you is a report that's directed from ORS 182.472, which instructs the Legislative Fiscal Office to receive reports from select semi-independent agencies. And if you want to know who's in and really who's in, because there's not really a who's out list, but who's in list is on page 2. There's 11 agencies that once a biennium must present to the Legislative Fiscal Office, the legislature, and the governor a report. Now, what's in this report? That's covered in the statute. It's under page 3 of the report. It generally covers things like audit, so what's the financial status, budget information, changes in budget information, changes in fees, material changes as it relates to public hearing processes, permanent and temporary rules, board actions concerning things like consumer protection, and a series of data points related to the licensing activity. So the numbers of licensees and the numbers of complaints related to the distinct licensing actions. And then the final point has to do with any additional information that the board might offer that facilitates the evaluation of agency performance. So this report was prepared by the Legislative Fiscal Office, and there's some recommendations in the executive summary, which is on page 1. The first thing that we concluded in this process, and it wasn't the first time we had done this, we did a report in 2006. The statute changed somewhat before that. There had been previous reporting, but under this sort of same statutory framework, this is the second report. The first report found that there was some inconsistencies. It made some recommendations about process, and those recommendations were adhered to somewhat, but there was still some ambiguity about when you submit something like financial reports, budget reports, what do they look like? In what format? What constitutes a budget report? We have a standardized system under the state umbrella, but within the semi-independent arena, they have some flexibility to decide what software package they might use, whether they have an accountant or a bookkeeper on staff. You know, their mechanisms for how they set up their books and do that kind of thing is under the purview of that entity. So there was some variance in the kinds of products we would get. So we felt that what we really needed to do is get a bar, a standard bar, about what does it look like? What should these reports include in terms of central context so that in the Legislative Fiscal Office we could make sure that they were actually complying with the statute and that we could do our job of evaluating performance. So you'll see in Appendix B a set of guidelines. And we worked with the agencies because we wanted them to be successful in providing this information. So we met with each agency head on the list, so all 11, and talked about what would be the series of sort of best practices in terms of reporting. So that was the first recommendation, and all of the agencies were agreeable to meeting those expectations. We also used these meetings as an opportunity to close any gaps. So if we had any concerns, we had follow-up conversations so that we could get to the point where our final conclusion that was that all of these entities really were complying with the statute at this point in time. The next recommendation has to do with financial reviews. In 2007, the legislature passed Senate Bill 70, which said that semi-independents, in addition or instead of a financial audit, they could do financial reviews. We talked from the legislative fiscal side with the Secretary of State's office, what's the difference between an audit and a financial review? And the way I understood it simply was that an audit is focused on finance, the financial component, a financial audit, where a review might enable a a little bit more focus and a little bit more depth in terms of what you study. So it wouldn't be necessarily a conclusion about the financial health, but it might be an effective conclusion about the bookkeeping system or something like that, as I understood it. So the semi-independence, when we talked about, well, what do you think about doing these reviews instead of an audit, they actually really liked the idea because they felt that it would give them better information for improving their processes. However, they were a little concerned that they wouldn't be perceived as valid, as being as reputable as an audit. Secretary of State's office assured us that they would be, that they are considered, you know, a legitimate financial tool. So we offered up here that maybe there's an opportunity to pilot this to see what could be learned in terms of what would a financial review provide in lieu of an audit. So that's the nature of the second recommendation. The third recommendation had to do with the audit time frames. The time cycle for when an agency needed to report on their finances and the release of audits were such that when an agency complied, which was to provide a copy of the most current audit, it was for an audit for the biennium prior to the biennium of all the other review content, data content. So it really was irrelevant to our assessment of performance of an agency to have such historical information. So we wanted to make sure that there was a recommendation that required that they submit to us as soon as it was available a copy of the audit that covered the time frame of the report. So that's the nature of the third recommendation. The final recommendation had to do with two entities on the list, the Patient Safety Commission and the Oregon Wine Board, which were non-licensing agencies. And when you read the statutory reference under subsection 5, all of the indicators of performance have to do with number of licensees. And if you're not a licensing entity, what do you provide in terms of performance measures? So we worked with both of these entities to say, what would your performance measures be if you were to report on a biennial basis? Would you be willing to standardize a couple? That's sort of been the expectation of other state agencies. We have this as a component, and subsection 5 of the statute, compliance might be read as one data point, but if you want it to be a performance measure, you need a point of reference. You need a comparison. So we set up templates, and that's in Appendix C, where each entity agreed to actually begin to provide historical context so we could actually do analysis and trending of these variables of licensing. So that's a component of the guidelines as well. And we wanted to bring those two other entities into that same realm of providing some kind of performance measure. So they were open and willing to do that as well. The final recommendation just had to do with some timing disconnects. Many of the pieces of the original statute reference having information provided from the last report to current, and the report was originally, the due date is January 1 of every even-numbered year. So if you were doing it from one report to another report, you were effectively reporting on a calendar year. But all the budgetary reference were to a fiscal year, and all the budgetary functioning and planning of the organization occurs on a biennial basis, not a calendar basis. So we wanted to get the timing connected to be all the same in the report, as well as to ensure that we had the proper Secretary of State audit that covered that same time frame. So there is, in Appendix D of this report, a ledge concept that was introduced by the Interim Joint Ways and Means Committee that tries to take care of some of those mechanical fixes so that the next round of reporting will have more clarity and alignment in terms of the timing of information, of what should be submitted and the timing of information. So this is what Legislative Fiscal Office does on a biennial basis. We prepare this report. It was presented to the Interim Joint Ways and Means Committee in November of last year now. And the expectation is that we would do a similar report under the statute, probably in a similar time frame, to be presented to an interim committee ahead of the 2000.
November of last year, for what time period?
For the biennium of the 2005-2007 biennium.
So in November of 2008, you reviewed the behavior of these organizations from July of 2005 to end of June of 2007.
Correct. We The Legislative Fiscal Office may have been able to get, I mean, we could have physically gotten the report in sooner. The report could be prepared probably May timeframe of 2008. We had special session and staffing issues.
Essentially 3 years after the period began.
Well, June 30th of 2007 would have been the end of the 05-07.
June of 05 would have been, July of 05 would have been the beginning of the period.
Yes, to June 30th, 2007.
In an ordinary agency, you would have been doing that in early 05. An agency that was not semi-independent, you would have been doing their budget review, looking at their
in at anticipation, their not so much in historic.
In 05 rather than in 08.
For the...
The 0507 biennium.
I can't get my head wrapped around the dates right now, but what I can say is the budget period we're ending right now, the 0709 biennium, we are now reviewing, of course, in ahead of the 0911 biennium.
Let me go back to that time period, because mm-hmm. that's a legitimate time period.
Okay.
We're talking about the period 05 to 07, the fiscal year 0507. Mm-hmm. In ordinary agencies, you would have been working on their budget in the beginning of the 05 session, right? You would have been reviewing their budgets. For the 05-07 biennium, you would have been reviewing their budgets at the beginning of the 05 legislative session, mm-hmm. looking at their performance and dealing with their budget for the period 05 to 07. In the case of the independents, you actually got to that retrospectively 3 years later in 08 for the same time period.
Your math sounds good.
Well, you said you did it in November of 08. Mm-hmm. You could have done it in May of 08.
We could have done it in May of 08.
And the others you did in May of 05. You can trust me on that.
Okay, I think I'm going to have to. It's the end of the day, and I'm sorry. If it's anything different than you're saying, I will get back to you, however.
Yeah. But this bill doesn't address.
This bill would put these three agencies into the prospective budget cycle.
I'm not disagreeing, but there's... But you don't... I mean, the bill... There's other ways to deal with that particular issue. I mean, by changing their calendar year, the fiscal year, their budgeting cycle, as opposed to taking
away... It would still have it 3 years after the cycle started.
Okay. So, I mean, that's...
I mean, it would have it 3 years later than for any other agency, than for the other 14 agencies.
Okay.
So...
And the problem is...
What do I see the problem is? I see the problem is there's basically no oversight because of that. That these agencies operate independently. As one of their execs referred to, they run it like a small business. And they refer to the legislature, they report to the legislature basically a year after their period ends. And nobody does anything with it. It has basically no effect. So the base proof of this was to put all the agencies on the same footing in terms of legislative oversight, prospectively looking at their budget, retrospectively looking at their performance criteria.
Because there's been a big problem?
Because we don't know if there's been a problem or not. I helped out on looking at some of the performance reviews, and basically nothing's been done with them. I mean, we don't have oversight. If you don't want oversight over these agencies, let's let all of them run their own small business.
Quite frankly, going the other direction might be appropriate also.
Well,
making them all semi-independent.
Turning them all loose entirely would be even easier.
Sure.
I may not go that far.
We got some testimonies to get to.
Oh, it might be helpful, not necessarily right now, but to clarify why you're pulling out the three boards for additional oversight versus all of them.
No, not additional. The three boards will now, I mean, if this
yes,
passes...
Yes, they'll go back into the regular process.
They'll all go back as the other 14 are.
Right, but why not all the other eight semi-independents? That's the question.
Oh, because they're not in our purview.
Okay.
I don't... We could take up the wine board here. truthfully, I mean, in terms of... I find very interesting the Patient Safety Commission because, in fact, I was involved in writing the statute for the Patient Safety Commission. I remember the day we were sitting in the library in the Legislative Council's office and we were writing the statute. And somebody said, oh, should this board be semi-independent agency? And we said... Well, what's a semi-independent agency? And the answer was, well, it's semi-independent. And we said, oh, okay, make it semi-independent. I mean, there was literally that much thought that went into the Patient Safety Commission. And I suspect that was probably not the right decision at that time, and may still not be right, but it was literally, I mean, that process stands out in my mind. So it isn't as if there was any thought that went into it in that case. Yes.
Mr. Chair, can I just clarify something with
you? We have a bunch of testimony.
I know we do, and I just want to, I think this may not have been clear, but in these reports, the semi-independent agency not only provides data relating to the biennium that has been completed, but also does present to you data on the upcoming, their budget, essentially, for
right.
the upcoming biennium. So they will tell LFO, and LFO will present to the legislature their prospective budgets or their adopted budgets. If I understand what they're asked to submit to you, this is in, I'm looking at Appendix B, the report that's due in 2008 includes the actual data from 05, 07, and then adopted budget for 07, 09.
Yeah, Chair Greenlick, Representative Ken, that is correct. We will receive that information. As the statute is now, it would be 6 months into the prospective biennium.
Mm-hmm.
One of the changes in the technical fix would give them a little more time, again, because we're waiting on those audits from Secretary of State, so it would give them till April 1. So there would be a 9 month into the prospective biennium, and that would be the time frame that we would receive.
Okay.
The information.
And do we do anything with it?
We
does
begin.
Anybody look at it and say, no, you can't do that?
We review the information in compliance to the statute, and if we have any questions in terms of the budgeting, you know, if there's material changes, we'll gather additional information about those material changes. So if they're increasing it, we'll document it, and any outline information would probably be tracked in the context of the report. There would be a place to do that, and then that would get reported to the legislative body for them to take action on.
That answer your question?
It does. It's helpful. Thanks.
Thank you. Let's thank you very much. We have one gentleman who's come a long way. We'll start the testimony with Scott Walters. And our intention is to try and deal with the three boards in some order, in some balance. And I ask you all to please keep your testimony as brief as possible. The information that you supply to us will be in the record. Please introduce yourself.
Chairman Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Dr. Scott Walters. I'm in private optometric group practice in Grants Pass, Oregon. I've been in practice for 20 years. I'm the immediate past president of the Oregon Board of Optometry, the OBO. I served on that board from December of 2001 through December of 2008. I'm also a past president of the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association, and I'm currently their senior past president, and I come to you today representing the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association, but having the perspective of a past board member, recent past board member. I'm also here because I truly believe that the best legislative concepts are those that fix a problem or protect citizens. And in my opinion, and those of who I represent, that HB 2057 does not do that. We feel there's no current problem with the semi-independent status of the Oregon Board of Optometry. Semi-independent status has been working for the OBO for 12 years very efficiently. Semi-independent agencies have been began in 1991 under Governor Barbara Roberts, and the Oregon Board of Optometry became a semi-independent agency in 1997 under Governor Kitzhaber. There are now, as you know, 14 semi-independent agencies. 9 are professional licensing boards, and 3, as you know, are health boards. For smaller agencies such as the OBO, we have the equivalent of 2.5 full-time employees, and we have 5 board members, including a board, public member. For us, the semi-independent model has been a perfect fit. Previous to semi-independence, the statutes and regulations that are enforced for regular agencies, they're set up for large agencies, and they were quite burdensome to small agencies such as the OBO. Therefore, the operations of the smaller boards, such as ours, were not as efficient as they could be, and they are now. The removal of these statutes, statutory provisions, particularly the budget that was just discussed, allows semi-independent agents to operate in a more business-like manner, and personally, I think that's a good thing. And therefore, we can focus more of our attention and more of our energy on our mission, which is to protect the public, and we take that seriously. I did speak to one of my colleagues, Dr. Joan Miller, who was a president, a couple presidents before I was. She served on the board from 1991 through 2002, so she saw before semi-independent and then after and during, and her comments, and I'll quote her, she stated that at any time we needed to make even the smallest changes to our budget, we would need permission. Even paying bills was a huge effort that took forever. That's her comments. And I witnessed firsthand also as president of the board and a board member before that, that efficiency and effectiveness are there under this model. We had up-to-the-date financial information available to us at all times. We had up-to-date information on what was happening with our licensees at all times. So I feel it's very effective. The semi-independent model is also very fiscally and financially responsible. All semi-independent agencies are self-funded and are fully supported just by the fees we charge to our licensees. There are no tax dollars involved in our agency and no general fund dollars involved. If HB 2057 were to become law, the cost of our operating the board would definitely increase. The OBO staff estimated that operating costs would increase $111,000 per biennium, which represents 18% of our current budget. And in today's economy, I don't think that's good fiscal policy. It's been brought up about...
Comment on why that is. What's that $118,000?
Actually, a better person to answer that question might be Mr. David Plunkett, our executive director, who formulated that number. So while semi-independent agencies are exempt from the budgetary process and administrative statutory provision there, the legislature, when they formed semi-independent agencies, made it increase the accountability for those agencies for their operation, including, as has been mentioned, the Oregon Audits Division performs an audit every 2 years, every biennium, whereas other state agencies haven't had an audit in over 10 years. On each even-numbered year, the semi-independent agency does submit a comprehensive report to the governor, the Speaker of the House, and the President of the Senate, as well as the LFO. And as you just heard, they review and report and make conclusions and findings to the Joint Legislative Audit Committee. The annual financial statements of all semi-independent agencies are required to be public, and as such, they're on all the agencies' websites. And budgets of semi-independent agencies are adopted only after public hearing, and the hearing notices go out to all of the stakeholders involved, including the licensees, so they can voice any concerns they have prior to the budget being adopted. The review and reporting mechanisms, we feel, are greater in number and also more comprehensive than those for regular state agencies. We also still have to be subject to public meetings laws, the Attorney General's Office, and Secretary of State, of course. So these semi-independent agencies have been able to accomplish, we feel, more with the same amount of resources, and when they can respond quickly to changes in their environment, and they've effectively been working within this model for 17 years. So we feel this group that I represent, feels there's no logical reason to change this. In fact, we would suggest that other agencies of our size, and possibly even some of the larger agencies, consider this as a very efficient, fiscally responsible way of conducting board business. Thank you for your time and consideration. I'd be glad to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming this far. I do want to note for the record that we offered you the opportunity to do it by phone.
You did?
Yes, we did.
It's on your recording machine.
Yes, we did. Can we have, what do we have? Glenith Moyle, Michael Jordan, and
Rose Jade
next, and then we'll have... is there anybody else here that's come a long way? Because we're clearly going to have to carry this over. Or maybe next Wednesday.
Portland?
Yeah, I come from there frequently. That doesn't count. You can give me my phone if you want. Yes, go ahead.
Who's going first?
You want me to pick somebody?
I'm fine with going first. Chair Greenlick, members of the Healthcare Committee, my name is Glenith Moyle, and I reside at 3941 Southwest, just up place to Oregon, Beaverton, Oregon, 97005. A little nervous here. I shouldn't be. It's about 15 years. Thank you. It's like, whoa. I have been a licensed massage therapist since 1989 and served as a board member of the Oregon Board of Massage from 1990 through 1997. For me, this is deja vu. I feel like I have stepped back 15 years. New legislature, new players, same subject. We spent a lot of time working with this process through some of those years. I strongly urge you to oppose the passage of House Bill 2057. Massage therapy, optometry, and physical therapy. I came up with an acronym. It's called MOP. During these challenging and stressful legislative session, I implore you to ask why we are trying to mop up which is not spilled. It doesn't seem relevant and cost-effective. At this, I can't see any identified problems. Why fix something that isn't broken? During my service with the OBMT, we began at the quest for semi-independence. And you have it all written in front of you, some of the following reasons. I would just like to talk about a couple of them. It was a one-size-fits-all budget process procedure that didn't fit. It was a mother-may-I process for the simplest requests, even to replace a printer. If additional funds were needed for an administrative hearing or legal counsel, a time and resource-consuming request had to be made to the emergency board. And I consider that a procedure reminiscent of Charles Dickens' Oliver Twist. Please, sir, I want some more. Semi-independent status for the OBMT.
How does it happen now? You have a budget, and now you need another $50,000.
Now? We don't...
You say, please, may I, too?
We don't. And I would refer that question back to our executive director. But if the board, you're talking about the state board, if the state board needs more money...
After they've adopted their budget, which is what you're talking about.
Yes, but except we have enough controls that we know how much is in our budget. We'd put up... Okay, so maybe I better go back in time a little bit here again.
Never mind.
Do you want me to go back in time?
No, I don't. I want you to go quickly forward in time.
Exactly. I can explain that whole process. It was really, really a difficult process. And, you know, we're all volunteer board members, and it took a lot of time to come to the e-board every time we didn't have enough money in our budget. And we were a growing profession in those days, and we still are. So semi-independent status for us came in 1999, and by that time I was off the board, which is great. But, you know, I'm still a licensed therapist and still pretty involved with the board itself. So some of the things I've seen with semi-independence, we did have improved customer service and responsiveness. The board members didn't have to go to the e-board. The board's ability to timely address the needs of the public protection. And there is greater accountability for those who understand the regulatory needs of the profession. And the gentleman before us talked about the rulemaking process and how we do, you know, put it out to the licensee. So as licensees, we have input into how the money is spent. In conclusion, I'd ask why there was no spill to mop and why proceed with such a retrograde action that appears to be based on some misinformation and lack of knowledge and understanding of the benefits that have accrued from our semi-independence. I thank you for this opportunity to present today.
Rose Jade, I'm a licensed massage therapist and attorney. I also have a graduate certificate degree in management of nonprofits. And one of the questions I had today about what this bill was about was answered when you explained that currently the legislature has no performance oversight of the board. And to me, that is a reason far in favor of this bill passing, because right now, as I understand it, and as I have used and relied upon it, if I've had a problem with the board, the only person I can go to is the governor's office. And the governor's office appoints the board. And so there's limited, in my view, there's some limited oversight given the fact that he's appointing these people that I may have a problem with. And I think that when you're a board that licenses in the name of the state of Oregon, that the consumers as well as the licensees have a right to be able to come to the legislature and talk about the performance of the board in the last 2 years and have some recourse here. So I would be in favor of it. Now, the one thing I have heard in the scuttlebutt, you know, from people working with the board sent out to the executive committee of the Oregon Massage Therapists Association, which I'm also a member of, is that if this passes, my licensing fees could go up perhaps 1,000%. So the fear factor as a licensee is that if the state legislature gains performance oversight, my fees
that,
are going to go up.
That came from your executive director?
That came from Heather, who left.
The executive director said that if this
not,
passes...
Not the executive director.
No, who was it that said if this passes, your fees will go up 1,000%?
She didn't say they would. She inferred, and I've got an email that she sent out to the executive committee of the Oregon Massage Therapists Association stating that, comparing this to what happened in Washington where the fees went up a huge amount. And so the fear factor is being put out there that if this passes, our fees are going to go up tremendously.
You can check. We have the history. When it went semi-independent, your fees dropped 90%?
They dropped $20.
They went from 100 down to 80.
And now they're back up to 100. But
4 years later.
You know, and I've asked people, I said, you know, could you show me some empirical data about why this is so bad, why having legislative oversight is so bad? Because, I don't know, it seemed like an okay idea to me. But that's their explanation, is if you take away our semi-independent status, we're going to have to go to all this extra expense, and your fees are going to go up right away, immediately, was the word she used, immediately. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you for... my name is Michael Jordan. I'm a retired police officer and a retired massage therapist. And I also served on the board for 6 years. So I wear lots of different hats, or have. I would like to speak to several things in regards to the board from past and present, and specifically really to the efficiencies. When I came on to the board in 2000, which is just a year after it became... semi-independent. At that time, the license was $100, which was fine. We had some a little over 1,000 therapists. We now have about 6,000. We're still at $100. You know, that's a pretty good efficiency to still be at $100 10 years later. That's doing relatively well. At that time, in 2000, I was asked to look at the investigations. The investigations had been left with the state investigative board, being as that we were a dependent agency. They had not been done. And I agreed to look at them pro bono because I was on the board. I was a retired police officer. At that time, there was 197 cases backlogged 4 years, including a severe, severe sexual case that was over 2 years old. In that case, the person was not only a sexual predator, he was still employed as an instructor at a massage school. And this case was so violent that it included tying a client down to a massage table. And the case was left sitting by the state investigative board when the board was an independent agency. That is no longer the case. We have our own investigators. And I cleared up 197 cases in 1 year.
Well, I think somebody's going to need to check on this.
I'm just telling you.
The nursing board has their own investigators.
Yeah, we have our own investigators now. When we were a dependent board, we did not. We have our own investigators now. We don't have that problem now. Like I say, when I came on the board in 2000, we had that problem. That no longer exists. That's efficiency. Cases come on now, they get handled.
It doesn't exist in the other agencies either.
Well, I know. It existed when we were a dependent agency.
I'm talking about the other dependent agencies.
I know. Well,
they have their own investigators.
Well, we didn't have our investigators then. We were dependent upon the state, and the state didn't do it. They left it. Cases 4 years old. And, you know, I'm a police officer, retired. I came on. I did these cases that were 4 years old. And that one case was 2 years old, sexual predator, still teaching at a massage school.
And you kept the same executive director after that?
The executive director is gone.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Also, I wanted to say, too, like I say, we've gone from, 1,000 massage therapists to 6,000.
Our fees are still of $100,000 to a budget of $600,000.
Well, our fees are still $100 per massage therapist.
The budget's now $600,000?
I have to ask Patty on what the budget is, but we still have gone from, like when I took my license, it took me 4 months in order just to get through the testing procedure. It took me 30 days to get my license. Now they get through their testing procedure in two weeks to 4 weeks, get their license in less than 24 hours. I waited, after I finished everything, almost a month to get my license. And, you figure 4 months after I spent $9,000, I want to start practicing and earn some money. These people are spending $15,000 or more to get through school. They want to get their license. They're getting their license in less time. That's efficiency.
Are there any questions of this panel? We have about 20 more to hear, which we're clearly not going to hear tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. The next group, Gerald Curtis, Roxanne Gillespie, Terry Bernhardt. And after that, we'll do probably one more panel.
Matthew Larrabee.
What is that? Matthew Larrabee.
Carl Stilham.
Carl Stilham and
Carl Royer.
And Carl Royer. And then we'll adjourn. So you guys are always standing between us and adjournment. Take your time.
We'll be quick.
Don't feel any pressure.
Our parking meter thing, too.
Yeah.
I'm Gerald Curtis, and I'm a licensed or a certified real estate appraiser in the state of Oregon. And I served on the Appraisal Certification and Licensure Board, which is an independent board, and was, I'm no longer on the board, but I eventually became the board chair. Next to me is Roxanne Gillespie, who was also board chair, and Terry Bernhardt was also board chair. We're all prior board chairs of the Appraisal Certification and Licensure Board, a semi-independent agency.
That's not in front of us at all right now.
Well, we're here to just briefly support.
I'd really move on to the next panel.
Okay,
please.
All right.
We just wanted to talk about semi-independent boards and what had happened to our agency at one point, where we had enforcement cases that had were almost 400 enforcement cases, and we were threatened with being shut down by the appraisal subcommittee at one point before we were a semi-independent agency. And so I'm here just to speak on the behalf of a semi-independent agency and the woes, the pluses and the minuses of the agency being independent, semi-independent, versus being under what we were under DCBS at the time. Would you like to hear that?
No.
Okay.
I'd like to move on to panels of the,
okay.
of the boards that are under consideration.
Thank you.
But thank you very much for coming.
The rest of these panels are also semi-independent. They're not associated with the three boards on the bill.
Is there anybody testifying here for the three boards on the bill? Okay, well, let's go with that. Steve Kapori, David Plunkett, and Wesley Vorpahl again. You were the first name.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Happy to have a constituent here.
Thank you. My legislator. My name is Stephen Kafori. I'm here today representing the Semi-Independent Boards Association. I'm representing the three licensed boards that are health-related and nine that are not health-related. I'll talk just about the health-related issues.
Thank you.
I'd like to give a short answer to your question first before I start my testimony, Mr. Chair. The short answer why we want to keep the status quo in terms of consumer protection. The short answer to that is we have two options. We can either have our staff spend their time doing unnecessary bureaucratic chores, or we can have our staff doing consumer protection activities. And we think that this bill would put us into the second or the first category. Governor Barbara Roberts started a reinventing state government. A lot of governors come and they're going to change everything. It's 1901. She had a bunch of people look at some means of doing so, and one of the suggestions that came out was Senate Bill 166 in 1993. Senator Neil Bryan, a Republican from Bend, had a bill in to take 34 agencies and make them semi-autonomous. The bill failed not because of any substantive reasons, but because of, as you know, things happen to bills around here for political reasons. The concept was that we would have small agencies that give them flexibility to handle their own business, purchasing, space rental, et cetera, that would be more efficiently done, at the same time keeping legislative and executive oversight, eliminating processes that made no sense for these small agencies. With the failure of that bill, I then took it upon myself to get those agencies that I represented at that time and several subsequently that I've represented as through the process of semi-autonomous. So I've watched this grow, and I've watched with my own clients, and I've seen what's happened to the clients. And as it succeeded, then I've talked to my other clients and said, this would be good for your agencies as well. When a crisis occurs, such as the nursing board crisis, the tendency for legislators is to take a look at a scattershot approach. Let's take a look at every kind of potential answer we can and have bills drafted. And then when you come down to the legislature, you say, of all these bills, which ones of these actually can we focus in on that will resolve the problem that we've been looking at? So we're not solving some problem that doesn't exist. We're only solving the problem we're looking at that happened. 2005-07 is, I think, an example of that. It really has nothing to do with the nursing crisis. The nursing crisis was a situation of a board that was independent. So making us be like the nursing board wouldn't approve anything.
Stephen, just for the record, we were well into this investigation before the nursing board crisis struck.
Okay. I think it would be apparent as you hear testimony about how the executive and legislative oversight that does occur under these boards, how it happens. At the same time, see what efficiencies occur by these semi-independent boards. You will see that leaving the status quo is the best for these boards. And as a matter of fact, as several people have said, you might take a look at making some more of these small boards semi-autonomous.
Chair Green, members of the committee. My name is Dr. Wesley Vorpahl, practicing optometric physician here in Salem, and I currently serve as vice president of the Oregon Board of Optometry. I'm going to negate quite a bit of my testimony, but I would like to make a couple of comments having to do with the efficiency of the boards and how that helps the board meet its mission of protecting the public and serving optometric physicians. At present, the Board of Optometry is able to examine complaints in a timely manner, generally in the meeting, in the next meeting after a complaint is received. This is possible because our staff has the time to prepare those complaints for the board's consideration. Should we lose our semi-independent status, this would likely not be the case. In fact, we would probably need to hire additional staff in order to maintain that level of efficiency. The other thing that I will bring up at this point is that the increase in flexibility that the board has to respond to various issues that affect the public and doctors in this ever-changing environment, currently under certain circumstances, the board is able to address the needs using administrative rules within statute 683.270 rather than going through the timely process of pursuing legislative action. For example, when optometric physicians obtain therapeutic privileges by statute, the formulary committee that was formed by that statute, consisting of pharmacists, medical doctors, and optometric physicians, recommended that the Board of Optometry take steps to ensure that rural optometric physicians obtain the necessary training in order to utilize those therapeutic privileges. This was needed in order to increase access to medical eye care in rural areas. As a semi-independent agency, we were able to act in a timely manner by implementing appropriate administrative rules rather than seeking legislative action that would have been necessary because of the expenditures involved. As a result, rural Oregon residents received improved access to eye care sooner rather than later. That's really the summary of my comments.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to answer one of the questions you raised, and that was the issue of going back to the emergency board and how does we get more money when we go to the emergency board. The issue is not going back to the emergency board and getting additional funds. The issue is going back to the emergency board to exchange from within the budget. Right now, because we operate our own budgets, we can take money out of one part of the budget and put it into another part of the budget. So if an emergency arises, like you have a case and you have to hire a lawyer, have to hire the attorney general, and it costs money, you don't have that in your legal budget, you can take it out of supplies budget. Right now, if we can do that internally on our own. But if we were back to being non-semi-autonomous, like the normal, we'd have to go to the emergency board and say, can we take out some money from supplies and put it into our legal fund? So it's the flexibility within our own budget, not getting more money. And that's what that kind of flexibility is what would happen, what we'd lose if the bill passes.
We'll see.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is David Plunkett, and I'm the executive director of the Oregon Board of Optometry. I would like to follow up on Mr. Kafouri's comment there. And we do have that flexibility. However, if for some reason the board decided it was not within the budget, then the process to do that is that the board would have a public hearing all over again, and if we had to have a revised budget. So that process is always in place where there's notice given and the board considers additional money. In 12 years, we have not had to do that. And so it's not something that will happen very often. I would just like to make a comment about the fact that in some of the history that was given in the beginning, that these things have happened by chance, and that's absolutely not true. You know, there have been studies of boards that have gone on.
Saying my testimony wasn't true?
No, I don't think that was your testimony.
Oh, yeah, it was.
But all I'm saying is that it hasn't been happenstance. It's been purposeful. I mean, boards, back in 93, the legislators considered all these things. There have been studies over the course of 25 years that I can remember of boards and how they function. So I think whether they're semi-independent or whether they're not semi-independent, Oregon boards have a very good reputation among the states. Oregon is considered a leader for the way they function. Regarding the you had a question that I would like to answer about the cost. We've estimated about $111,000 in additional fees if we lost semi-independence. Those are fees that would be charged, implemented by DAS, for the most part, that we don't have to pay now. One big ticket item on that list would be accounting. The accounting charges for our board is estimated would cost us $57,000. We now do it in-house at no cost, except our staff time.
Yeah, no cost? I'd like to get some of that no-cost stuff for some of my work.
Well, you can do this from an off-the-shelf accounting package of QuickBooks Pro for $180, and it's all these small boards need. CPA firms have recommended that in consultation. It seems to work quite well. I have access to more information now as a semi-independent agency than I ever had previous to that. I had to wait 4 to 6 weeks for reports after the end of a month. I understand that has improved, and now it's only about 2 weeks. I can do an interim report at any time within 30 seconds at my desk and know where we stand financially. This is flexibility that I think all managers should have. Those are the kind of efficiencies that I think that we can have. I won't go into the details of all the extra safeguards. I think some of the others have done that. But I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Well, I'm really committed to trying to get our committee starting on time and ending on time. So I'm going to end this session. But here, there have been a lot of interesting questions raised today, and it would be useful to have some information. So I'm going to ask some of our staff folks to get involved. And I'd like to see if we can get some data, for example, on the comparison of the budget per licensee for, say, your board and the nursing board offhand as an example, and see whether that's happened. I'd also like to look into, I think I heard some inferences that you can't have your own investigative staff if you're not a semi-independent agency. I'd like to check in on that, you know, the two-year lag in getting cases. I mean, there's some things I've heard, some assertions that I think would be very useful for us to get some information on, so we...
And if I may add, is the auditing, there was testimony that the independent boards are audited every 2 years, and that the other boards aren't necessarily audited every other year, and so...
In terms of Secretary of State's audits?
Well, financial audits. Yeah. And what are the other boards doing for... Because they don't do internal audits, they're doing external audits.
Well, I think it is. I mean, I think it's very useful for us to get some light to go with some of the heat we've heard. And I understand, I really do understand the sense that this is concerning to boards that are operating in a certain way. I do understand that. And again, I think the sense is that it's not that we believe something is broken. It's the fact that we don't have a clue whether it's broken or not. That's the problem. The problem is we've been groping for how boards and commissions, how oversight happens in boards and commissions, and we've just found there's not a very clear-cut answer to who's in charge, and it's something that worries us. Representative Thompson, last word.
Mr. Chair, I'm new here, so I get to ask 5 stupid questions before I'm going to.
You can ask more than 5.
Okay. Well, one of the things, I don't understand, why are we looking at bringing these boards back in instead of looking at the best model for boards what I'm hearing today is that we don't have any problems with these boards, and we certainly have some problems with boards that are under the state umbrella. Might we not want to look at a best model, best practices concept, and maybe set more boards free? That's a rhetorical question, but is there some historic reason that we're looking at this right now? Or
yeah, we actually, that's not a stupid question, but it really takes us back a little over 2 years to where we started this discussion. There were a variety of issues raised about the boards, particularly the question of who has oversight over the boards. So we began a very systematic review, and we'll be glad to send some of that paper along to you, where we looked over the 17 health licensing boards. And what we found was there was no best practice. There was no consistency. You'll get a bill next Wednesday where we'll try and standardize who's appointed to a board. So, for example, we had situations where the members were serving at the pleasure of the governor. The members could only be removed for cause. The members could only be removed if the board asked the governor to remove them, or there was nothing about that. And as we went through a set of things where we tried to find where was the best model, we did try and ask the question, who's in charge? Where's oversight on these boards? And we found just great vagueness and our inability to have any sense that there was some systematic way to manage these boards. So we looked at a set of things. One was the public members. One was this question of semi-independent versus independent. One was the question of how board members get appointed and not appointed, and came to some conclusions that we ought to try and at least come to some understanding of where this was. Now, with the semi-independence, the thing that was worrying about us is the other 14 boards bring their budget to Ways and Means. Their budget is vetted in Ways and Means. It's not vetted very hard because there are other funds, not general funds, but it is vetted. They're required to have, in advance of getting a budget, they're required to have performance measures and to report how the performance measures they did before worked. And there, we had legislative oversight through the Ways and Means process. As we heard here, the legislative oversight comes way, way downstream. So it's, for example, 3 years after the start of a biennium, the legislature gets a report, which basically they've never done anything with. So, I mean, we literally haven't had fiscal oversight over those. So the boards, as I think it was referred to, they like to operate as a small business. And I would be good with that, except I understand what the small business failure rate is in this state. So I'm not sure that's always the best way.
No. After you're up and running for a few years, you've got a pretty good chance of survival.
Yeah,
it's the startups.
Maybe 25% instead of 50% failure rate.
Well, yeah, because you don't have your kid to hand it to. I mean, here it's different ballgame. Come on.
But that is what I mean. This didn't pop out of the blue as an arbitrary and capricious basis. We started working on this midway through the 2007 session and have done a ton of work on it. Now, have we got the right answers? I think this is up to this committee to decide.
One of my concerns, I guess, is I followed fairly intimately the problems at the Board of Nursing, which was a board under the umbrella and did have legislative and fiscal oversight, and it didn't seem to do any good. I mean, I'm well aware since Holly's taken over, there's been a miraculous turnaround there in a very short period of time. But it makes me wonder if maybe we have oversight problems within the system independent boards might be more responsible with.
Well, I don't think there's any evidence they're more responsible, but there's no question that we haven't solved the problem across the 17
boards. I guess yet. I would enter, can we find the best practices, best model, and maybe Thank pursue you. That would be my dream.
This is a quest for that.
Okay. I'm satisfied.
Mr. Chair, we're interested in helping in that process.
Good. You want
to? I just want to, Mr. Chair, before you gavel out, we had two pieces of written testimony submitted for the record from folks who couldn't attend here. One was from the American Massage Therapy Association, in opposition to House Bill 2057, and the other one is from the Real Estate Valuation and Consulting Services, Richard Herman, in opposition to HB 2057.
Thank you very much.
More paperwork to come.
And more testimony. We'll close the hearing on 2057, and we'll adjourn. Thank you very much.
Thank you.